at me, as at an apparition that had walked into their midst. Then a boy who had been kicking a ball in the village square saw me and called to his playfellows. They shouted at one another, but not with fear, neither with hatred. No, it was excitement, even a sort of delight. I looked at them curiously. Several of the fishermen left their boats and walked toward me. Ah, I thought, now the stoning will start. But I could not make myself turn and walk away. These were the first men I had seen apart from my father. I wanted to stay with them and continue to smell the tantalizing scent of fresh bread from the bakery. One of them, roughly dressed, his face red from the sun and wind, stood before me and said,
"What are you then? Some sort of freak?"
But I did not understand him, for my father had taught me only French, which was his native language and the language of Justine Moritz. "Pardon, monsieur, je ne comprends pas ce que vous dites," I said. "Je suis fatigué et affamé, et je prie que vous puissiez me donner un peu de pain." A little bread. That was what I wanted more than anything on earth.
"She's a foreigner," said another one of them.
"She's a giantess," said the boy with the ball. "Like the one at the fair, but even taller. I wonder how strong she is."
He pulled up his sleeves, clenched his fists, and made muscles as though he were a strong man himself.
"Are you strong, giantess?" he asked.
"Giantess? La géante?" They were not afraid of me. I was, to them, a figure out of a fairy tale. I pulled up my sleeve and showed the boy my muscles. They were not particularly impressive, for my arms were as slender then as they are now. He looked disappointed. I smiled and lifted a wheelbarrow that had been left by the side of the square over my head. "It's not large muscles that make you strong," I wanted to tell him. He laughed, delighted, and the other boys applauded, and then the fishermen. They asked me to lift more things. A log that had been cut for a mast, a rather large pig. Hearing their shouts and laughter, the shopkeepers came out of their shops, the butcher and grocer, the baker with his apron still on. Soon I had a circle of villagers around me, all wanting to see me perform feats of strength. One of them threw a coin at my feet. And soon there were other coins, not many, but a few. They clinked on the cobblestones. I gathered them up and put them into the pocket of my skirt. I was starting to tire, for I had walked long and slept little. I bowed to the villagers, signaling that I was done for the day. They clapped and began to disperse, but the baker's wife ran into the bakery and brought out a loaf for me, with a smile and a shake of her head to indicate that I would not have to pay for it. I blessed her in French, but I believe she understood me. As I left that square, most of the loaf under my arm, the rest in my mouth, I looked at myself in the bakery window. I had never seen my own reflection. My father's cottage had no mirror, and I had not passed a lake or pond or even puddle, no water still enough that I could see myself in it. I stared at myself. I looked ordinary. Taller than women are, but there was nothing hideous about me. I could pass among human beings. It came as a relief. You have seen Adam, his hideous countenance. Any part of it would be handsome enough, but altogether. My father had made him from corpses that had lain dead some days, taking what body parts were not yet corrupted. He had not been preserved carefully as I was, and my father had been younger, less experienced. I was no longer the pretty girl who had called herself Justine Moritz, but I was not a monster. I continued walking south along the coast. I slept in meadows and pastures, finding what shelter I could, beneath a tree, or in a barn or shepherd's hut. Sometimes I stopped in the villages. In one I saw a man painting a boat with pitch to make it waterproof, and I begged him in gestures for his brush. On a broken piece of wood I painted in black letters, "Géantesse, Strang Women." These were the words I had heard the villagers speak. When I showed my sign in the towns, which were getting larger, I would be given coins, with which I could buy bread and cheese and onions. By this time I had a canvas bag and a pair of men's shoes and an old hat to gather the coins in. But I kept on moving, always afraid that Adam would find me, afraid he would hear of the géantesse who performed in the towns. Perhaps I had killed him, but no. Although I tried to tell myself that he must be dead, something in me did not believe it. My only safety lay in the fact that men ran from him or attacked him instinctively. Although I did not know it, I had made my way down to Cornwall in the south of England. There one night I was showing my strength in a town square when a man staggered out of a tavern and challenged me. He was drunk and wanted to wrestle, to show that he was stronger than me. What was I, after all? A woman, and no woman was stronger than a man. I understood this in part. I was learning English from my encounters with Englishmen, although all of them seemed to speak in different accents, and what I later realized was Welsh I could not understand at all. I thought for a time that I had wandered into another country. This man was challenging me, it was clear, and I waved my hand to signal that no, I would not wrestle with him. No, no, I said, clearly I thought. But his companions came out of the tavern and surrounded me. Then he lunged. I had meant to step aside, to let him stumble past. But as he came, all I could see was Adam, coming toward me, hands outstretched. He was not Adam, not a monster, only a man. So I reached toward him, grasped him by the throat, and snapped his neck. He crumpled as his companions looked on, dumbfounded, not certain what had happened. There was an opening in the circle they made. I turned and ran through it, leaving my sign and hat behind on the pavement. I ran and ran, knowing what would happen now, what human justice was. Had I not been hanged once? I had no wish to be tried again for murder, although I deserved it, for I had killed a man. This time I was guilty. Catherine, although you know perfectly well it was in self-defense. Justine, but this is my story, as I know and feel it. In my heart I knew myself to be a murderer. That night I longed to die. I was afraid to surrender myself to the justice of man, but wished that the justice of God would strike me down. I ran through the night, following roads headed I knew not where, away from the town where I had committed such a heinous crime. Overhead, clouds alternately concealed and revealed the sliver of a moon, which threw the shadows of trees across my path like bars. Diana.
Oh, please! Cut the symbolism already!
Like prison bars. At last the roads dwindled down to mere paths, and then I was stumbling across fields, with the stubble of mown hay scratching my bare legs above my shoes. It grew darker. Clouds covered the moon, so I could no longer rely on it to give me a sense of direction. The fields gave way to rockier ground, on which I was in danger of twisting my ankles. I scarcely noticed when the rain began. At first a few drops I brushed off my hair, and then as though the heavens had opened up a deluge. I stood in a field and looked up at the sky, water streaming down my shoulders and over my arms, soaking my clothes. Then and there I prayed God would strike me down with a bolt of his lightning. Surely that was in his power, and surely I deserved to die. But he did not strike me down. There was nothing to do but trudge on through the darkness, not knowing where I was going. And so I trudged. I did not see the wall. I simply walked into it, then along it, feeling my way, my hands on the cold, slick stones. At last I felt something, the wood of a door. There was a handle which turned under my hand, and then I was inside, my shoes squelching on the floor. I took them off and walked carefully, feeling my way. Where was I? A barn of some sort? There was something soft under my feet, and then something hard against my knee, something I had walked into with a thump. I cried out in pain, and the cry echoed, as though I were in a large space. A barn, then, I was certain. I felt around me. There was a sort of pallet covered with cloth. I could do no more. Without light, I would only wander aimlessly. Whoever discovered me here in the morning might take me to prison. I was so tired and wet that I no longer cared. I clutched at the pallet and fell upon it, sobbing with exhaustion. And then I believe I lost consciousness, overwrought with the fears and horrors of that night. The next morning I woke and looked around me with astonishment. Sunlight streamed through the windows. I was in a large room, as magnificent as any in the Frankenstein's house. The floor was covered with a carpet in dim, rich colors. On the walls were paintings of men and women in the garb of previous centuries, and shelves upon shelves of books, hundreds of books. Sunlight glinted off the gold titles on their spines. The pallet on which I had fallen the night before was a sofa, upholstered in velvet, and what I had bruised my knee on was a low table, with designs inlaid in ivory and exotic woods. It was the library of a wealthy family. Justine Moritz knew that. But everywhere there was a sense of neglect. The carpet was moth-eaten. The books and furniture were covered with dust. The curtains that hung at the windows had faded, and there were cobwebs in the corners of the room. The barn I thought I had stumbled into was a grand house. Magnificent, but utterly deserted. I wandered through that house in astonishment, my bare feet cold on the floors. Everywhere it was the same, dust and decay. I did not know until much later that the house was the seat of an aristocratic family. When the old Earl died, his son had inherited the property, but had so indebted himself that he could no longer afford to live there or keep it up. Neither could he sell, for the property was entailed. The house, its contents, and the surrounding estate could not be sold, but passed automatically to the next heir. The son had gone off to farm in Africa, and his son after him stayed there, never returning to England. So the house was left to the moths and spiders, and to me. I had nowhere to go, no one in the world to whom I belonged, for I did not consider myself bound to Adam. That morning I found a broom and swept away the cobwebs from the mouldings and chandeliers. I took the rugs outside and beat them until you could see their colors again like jewels. I wiped the tables and chairs with a soft cloth and promised them I would find beeswax, so they would shine as they had before. I washed the windows with white vinegar from the butler's pantry. Finally, I dusted the books, as Justine Moritz would have done. Remember that I had been a maid. What I had known best in the world before my father taught me philosophy and literature was cleaning. I knew how to launder fine linen, polish silver, keep a great house. My brain might have forgotten, but my hands remembered. I found myself a room, one of the maid's rooms, for I did not wish to be presumptuous. When I was done cleaning, I washed my clothes and myself in a tub I filled from a well behind the house. It was a relief to be truly clean for the first time in weeks. But I was hungry, and there was no food. Whatever had been left in the house had been eaten long ago, probably by mice, for I found their droppings. So I went outside. Through the second-floor windows I had seen a walled garden beyond the hedges that surrounded the house. I discovered it was a kitchen garden, large, although neglected. It had once provided produce for the entire household, and I could still see vegetables among the weeds. Beyond it was an orchard, also walled to protect the fruit trees from the sea winds. I could not tell what kinds of fruit grew there, for I did not know how to distinguish apples and pears and quinces. But Justine Moritz remembered they would someday be good to eat. Slowly I began to discover that there would be enough food for me. Now there were asparagus and lettuce, Later there would be cabbage and cauliflower and courgette. If I tended the garden now, there would be a full harvest in autumn, and for winter I could store the cabbages that were already developing. The house stood on a high path above the shore, but there was a path down to the rocks. There I found mussels and snails, which I already knew I could eat. Later I would find a way to fish. I had seen men do it with nets, and there must be a net somewhere in that house. I stood on the rocky shore, eating the green sprouts of asparagus and broccoli that I had brought with me to assuage my hunger. Yes, I could live here. I had food and water, a bed for the night. I had that library of neglected books. What more did I need? I was completely alone, except for the mice and the owls that nested in the attic, whom I did not disturb. It was my own Eden, and I was its Eve. I thought it was paradise. I will not tell you the story of those years, for there is no story to tell. Season after season, I planted my garden, fished from the sea with what had once been a tennis net, and read the books in the library. It had been the library of an educated man, so I read the philosophers and great poets. I taught myself English and Latin, and also a little Greek. In what had been a lady's chamber, I found pencils and paints, and amused myself by sketching and painting until my supplies ran out. Sometimes I found a honeycomb and stole part of it from the bees. Their stings could not wound me. I always felt like a thief, but what sweetness! Once a stray cat came, and her progeny lived with me for the rest of my time there, keeping down the population of mice. I rarely left the environs of the house. Although I did not realize it, the estate surrounding that house was extensive, and no one had reason to trespass on it but poachers after hare. Sometimes I saw and disabled their traps. I thought, surely someone will come, a caretaker, if no one else. I kept a bag packed, ready to flee should I need to. But no one ever came. I lived simply and happily enough, although I missed my father and my kind, the companionship of another with whom I could converse. I had everything I needed but a friend. I did not realize that a legend had grown about the Cornish giantess who roamed that stretch of shore. I suppose I had been seen searching for food among the rocks. That is how Catherine found me. One day, it was in late summer, I think, for the gourds were hanging heavy on their vines, I looked up, and there, sitting on the garden wall, was a woman. She was bareheaded and barefoot, in a simple linen dress, with a straw hat on the wall next to her. She had strange yellow eyes, and she sat looking at me as though she had been there a long time. It had been so long since I had seen another of my kind, that I stepped back and shrieked. It sounded like the call of a bird, one of the falcons that sometimes circled overhead. How long was it since I had last spoken? "Do not be afraid," she said in English. She pulled down the collar of her dress, which was unbuttoned at the top. "Look, I too am made. I too am a monster. Monstrum sum." Catherine. I wasn't even sure if she would understand me. What if she spoke only French or German? But I thought she would understand the scars. As to who she was, that was a guess on my part. I was traveling with the Circus of Marvels and Delights through Cornwall. One day a man said to Lorenzo, "You should get the Cornish giantess, you should. Make a fortune." He told the story of a giantess who had lived by the seashore for 100 years. Lorenzo thought it was only a story. After all, it was 100 years old. But I began to wonder. Moreau had talked about Frankenstein's experiment. Victor Frankenstein had gone to England, specifically to England, to create a female monster, but he had never completed his task. Afraid that his male and female monsters would reproduce, he had disassembled her and thrown her body parts into the sea. That's what I knew from Mrs. Shelley's account.
Mary. Which is a pack of lies.
Catherine. Yes, I began to suspect it was inaccurate when I heard of the Cornish giantess.
But why did she lie, Mary?
Mary.
To protect Frankenstein. To protect the Société des Alchimistes.
Catherine. I don't think so. What I think is...
Justine. Please? Can we finish my story?
I had no food to offer this catwoman, who had guessed my identity and sought me out. At that time I ate only vegetables and what I could scavenge from the sea, which I did not even cook, for fear of attracting attention to myself. But she said she was not interested in eating. She was interested in listening.
"And so you've lived here ever since," she said to me after I had told her my story, such as it was.
"Yes," I said. My throat ached from talking so much.
"Alone, all this time?"
"Yes, but it does not seem so long. I have books, I have my garden."
"Justine, you've been living in this house for almost 100 years.
It startled me that so much time had passed. I had no clock, no calendar. I had not kept track of the passage of time. I did not age, and evidently I could not die. I knew many winters had come and gone, but...
I did not know, I said, feeling for the first time a sense of desolation.
Everything Justine Moritz had known was gone.
You can't stay here forever, she said. For one thing, the world is changing. The 19th century is coming to an end. Although you don't feel it here yet, the towns are growing larger, and there are more people in them. Soon they will be everywhere, even here. And this house has been sold. I heard people at the sideshow talking about it. The current heir is a woman, raised in Africa, and rich from a coffee plantation. She sued to break the entail, and won. People don't like entails much anymore. The land will be developed. It will become a grand hotel surrounded by seaside cottages. There is a mania now for going to the seaside. I can't imagine why. For another, you can't live alone your entire existence. That's not right. It's not... No one should have to live alone for so long. And I happen to need a friend. And the circus does not have a giantess. That is how I left my place of refuge and solitude. I joined the circus of marvels and delights. And the rest? You know.
Chapter 20. The Athena Club. When Justine finished her story, the room was silent. Except, of course, for the sound of Diana chewing the last piece of Justine's toast.
Damn that girl, Mary thought.
Really? Her language was deteriorating with Diana around. She would have to make sure that Justine got a proper breakfast.
Finally, Holmes said, "And no one came to the house? Not for 100 years? That seems unusual. I've heard stories of such entails and the difficulties they cause, particularly when a case goes to Chancery. But surely there would have been a caretaker of some sort."
"Truly there wasn't," said Justine. "Well, there was a boy, once. It was when I had been there half a century, perhaps. He came to find the giantess. The people on that coast were poor farmers. They had no interest in whether the legend was true. It was enough for them that their fathers and grandfathers had spoken of a giantess. They repeated the stories they had been told. They were simply trying to survive. But that boy, he was different. He wanted to know for himself. I say boy, but he was already half a man. 17 or 18, perhaps. He was already more mature than men twice his age."
Holmes looked puzzled. Was he connected with the estate in any way?
"Not as far as I know. He said he was up from the coast and had come to a local village during his school vacation. He was the sort of boy who collects seashells, who digs up bones and shards of pottery, He was inquisitive and particularly interested in the geology of that area. I showed him the library and told him that he could read whatever he liked. He would visit once or twice a week. He helped me to practice English, and we even talked a little in Latin. We became friends. Then one day he told me that he could not come any more. His landlady had become suspicious about his long walks, and he did not want to put me in danger. So he stopped coming. He promised that he would never tell anyone about me.
"Did he ever ask you about yourself, who you were and how you were made?" asked Holmes. He sounded skeptical, suspicious.
I do not remember him asking, but I told him.
Justine leaned forward as though suddenly struck by the thought.
I told him about the Société des Alchimistes.
Could he have been a member of the society? Asked Holmes.
I do not know. But he was so young, surely not.
Frankenstein was young when he created Adam, said Catherine. But you know who he was. You told me his name, remember?
William something.
Yes, William Pengelly. I called him Will, and sometimes when I was particularly pleased with him, Guillaume. My one friend in all that time, other than the cats, of course.
Miss Frankenstein, said Holmes, clearly astonished. William Pengelly, the geologist. Pengelly, who excavated Kent's cavern and proved the earth could not possibly be 6,000 years old, as Bishop Usher had suggested.
You know him, then? Said Justine. Oh, perhaps I could speak with him again. How I would like that.
She smiled a pale, wan smile, as though remembering their friendship with pleasure.
Speak with him? No, he died several years ago, an old man. I did not know him myself, but he was well known to anyone with an interest in science and the inductive method of reasoning. He was a respected member of the Royal Society. He could not possibly have had anything to do with the Société des Alchimistes. And yet there must have been a reason for him to be there. It could not have been a coincidence. Just as one part of this case begins to make sense, it becomes more inscrutable.
Then you don't believe he was simply my friend? Said Justine, looking as sad as Mary had ever seen her.
Of course he was your friend, said Catherine. I have to admit this is starting to sound... Well, clearly he wasn't just a village boy, but that doesn't mean he wasn't your friend, Justine.
My brother Mycroft has contacts in the Royal Society. Perhaps they can tell us more about this Pengelly, said Holmes. It seems clear that we have solved one mystery. We know who committed the Whitechapel murders and why. Now we must solve the mystery of the Société des Alchimistes. What is it? Who are its members? Is it still carrying on its illicit activities, particularly in England? But I promised Lestrade that I would return as soon as I could. I left him with very little information, just enough to charge Hyde with the murder of Molly Keane.
He stood, looking both worried and impatient.
Miss Jekyll, if you'll excuse me, I will go trouble Mrs. Hudson for a meal of some sort and another coat, since Miss Moreau is still wearing mine, then take a cab back to Scotland Yard. I have a lot to tell Lestrade, and I'm not sure how much of it he will credit. He's not the sort to believe in 100-year-old giants or beast-men. He will likely dismiss it all as a fairy tale and look for the most ordinary explanation, that Adam was a madman, and the more improbable parts of the story are simply figments of my imagination. From long association I know how he thinks, you see. Then I must send a message to Lord Avebury, who will not be getting his menagerie back, although who knows, the orangutan may head home if he indeed escaped the fire.
Of course, Mr. Holmes, said Mary. And we will see you... when?
Tomorrow, perhaps. I will, of course, bring you news of Watson, but you... I believe you should all get some rest. It has been a difficult night for you all.
Mary nodded. Yes, it had been difficult. But exciting, too, she could not deny that.
Did she want to experience any more such nights? Stalking a suspect through London with Mr. Holmes? Solving mysteries?
Well, not tonight.
That was for certain. Holmes bowed and said, "Until tomorrow, then." With a couple of long strides, he was out the door. As he passed her, Alice started as though remembering where she was, and then followed him out, still holding the breakfast tray. Mary heard the voice of Mrs. Poole below, then the front door closing, and then silence. Suddenly she realized they were all looking at her. Justine leaning back against her pillow, Diana sitting cross-legged on the bed, Catherine with her legs curled under her like a cat, Beatrice in her chair by the window. They were all waiting for Mary to speak.
"Well," said Diana, "now what?"
Now what, indeed? She knew what she wanted to say, but would they agree? The only way to find out was to ask.
"What I'd like is for you all to stay here. I've lost all the family I had."
Hyde did not count, of course.
"I think we've all lost our families, haven't we? Diana has no one. Beatrice may still have relations in Italy."
Beatrice shook her head.
"But anyone Justine knew is long dead. And Cat, well, she had no human family, at least. I want us to be a family for each other. Anyway, we still have a mystery to solve. As Mr. Holmes said, we know who committed the Whitechapel murders, but we know almost nothing about the Alchemical Society. What sorts of experiments were our fathers conducting? What were they trying to prove? We know it had to do with biological transmutation, but there were papers. They met to give papers, remember? Are there papers about Beatrice or Catherine? Or even Justine? Is there a journal? Societies usually have journals, don't they? Beatrice, didn't you mention a journal of some sort? There's still so much we don't know. It seems clear that the society was not directly responsible for the Whitechapel murders. My father had been cast out of the society, and Prendick, who is still a member, was hiding his activities from them. Adam was an experiment, wasn't he? Rather than a scientist. And he mentioned that they, whoever they are, wouldn't let him join. But the society did sanction the creation of, well, of monsters. Girl monsters. Is it continuing those activities? If so, it must be stopped. I have no idea what we're going to live on, because we'll run out of money soon. Still, I think we should all stay here and find a way." There. She had said it. Now she waited to see how they would all respond. Justine nodded. "Yes, we should certainly try to stop the Société, although it will not be easy. You are right. We must solve this mystery together. We are like sisters, are we not? I lost my own sisters when I was sent into service, and then when I died and was reborn. I would like to have sisters again."
"Speak for yourself," said Diana, with an expression of disgust. "I have one sister and she's bad enough. Anyway, what about poison breath? I saw what happened in that warehouse. Are we all going to die in our sleep?"
"That was scarcely her fault," said Mary.
"No, Diana is right," said Beatrice. "I will always be dangerous. If I stay here, I must spend most of my time in the laboratory, so my poison does not affect you all. I agree that we must try to stop the Société des Alchimistes, but are you certain that you wish me to stay?"
"No," said Diana, and
"yes," and
"yes, of course,"
said Mary and Justine simultaneously.
"Catherine,"
said Mary, realizing she had not yet spoken.
"I don't know," said Catherine. "We'll fight, inevitably. I don't just mean Diana sticking knives into people, which doesn't count. What I mean is that we're opinionated. We'll want our own way. Except maybe Justine, who has to be gentle because she's so strong. It won't be a peaceful life with all of us here."
"I know," said Mary. "But families do fight, don't they? Anyway, I think we're stronger together than apart."
"Maybe."
Catherine frowned. "Anyway, I'm a puma. I'm solitary and secretive, according to the Encyclopedia Britannica in your father's study. Yes, we need to stop the society if it's still creating, well, more of us. But I'm not sure I want to be anyone's sister.
But you've been like a sister to me, said Justine gently.
Catherine merely shook her head and said, I'll have to think about it.
Perhaps we should all do that, said Mary. Let's get some rest. We all need it. And then can we talk again later? I'm sure if I ask nicely, Mrs. Poole will make us a proper tea, with sandwiches and cakes. And sausages, of course, she said, looking at Catherine. And delicious green goo, she added, for Beatrice's sake.
Diana stuck a finger in her mouth and pretended to vomit, presumably commenting on Beatrice's choice of nourishment.
You know, said Mary dispassionately, you may not have to wait for Beatrice's poison. I'm seriously considering smothering you with a pillow while you sleep, just to keep you quiet for a while.
Suddenly, Justine started to laugh. She put a hand over her mouth as though embarrassed, trying to hold it in. But then Beatrice started as well, elegant, musical laughter, as one might expect from Beatrice. Catherine threw her head back and laughed heartily without restraint. Mary looked startled, but then even she started, and could not stop until her sides hurt. She had not laughed since... Well, when had she ever laughed? It was painful, yet it brought a sense of release, as though a key had turned in her chest and opened a lock she did not know was there.
I'd like to see you try, said Diana indignantly. Anyway, I'm going to my room. I had a long night rescuing poison breath over there in case anyone's forgotten.
She yawned conspicuously, crammed the last of Justine's toast into her mouth, and walked out of the room, nose in the air, with a smear of marmalade across one cheek, like a damp, barefoot duchess.
Her room, said Mary. When did it become her room? Just now, I think, said Beatrice, wiping tears from her eyes. You said you wanted us all to stay, didn't you? Including Diana. But I think we had better go to our rooms as well. Justine is getting no rest with us here.
Before they left, Mary persuaded Justine to finish the vegetable broth. Then she took the tray back down to the kitchen and checked with Mrs. Poole to make sure the housekeeper still had enough money for necessities. Yes, Mrs. Poole told her, for the moment. She was being economical, but the rates were coming due, and Diana would eat them out of house and home for sure. Mary thought again about her bank balance. £41, 12 shillings. How would it feed 7? Herself, Diana, Beatrice, Catherine, and Justine, plus Alice and Mrs. Poole? Well, 6, since Beatrice barely ate. She assumed green goo was cheap, but she was too tired to think about it right now. She walked back upstairs to her room. On the way, she checked on Justine, who was fast asleep and snoring gently under a blanket that did not quite cover the more than 6 feet of her. Catherine's door was closed, but Mary supposed she was asleep as well. Diana was still awake, lying in Mary's childhood bed with her knees up and a book propped on them.
Go away,
she said, sticking her tongue out. Mary went in and kissed Diana on the forehead, as her mother had kissed her when she was a child. Why had she done that? She did not know. Instinct, she supposed. To her surprise, Diana did not actually hit her, but she did rub her head as though wiping away the offending kiss.
Gross,
was all she said. Diana.
And it was, and it still is.
Mary. But you didn't hit me.
You never hit me when I do it.
Diana.
Is that supposed to mean something? Because it doesn't.
Catherine. Not hitting people is how you show affection. She lay down on her bed, just for a minute. Then she would get up and change into a nightgown. In just a minute. By the time that minute had passed, she was asleep. Diana had not wanted to sleep. Mary had told her to sleep, so she wouldn't. When she got to her room, she sat on the floor looking at the bookshelf. These must be the books Mary had grown up with. A Child's History of England. Boring. Poetical Fancies. Who named these books? Alice in Wonderland. That looked better. She took it off the shelf and into bed with her. Ah, this was more like it. Soon she was down the rabbit hole, and in a land as chaotic as her own mind, with caucus races and Cheshire cats that disappeared, leaving their grins, and mad hatters holding tea parties. She particularly admired the Queen of Hearts. Diana,
see, you can write perfectly well from my perspective when you want to. Told you so.
Catherine had gone to her room and shut the door, wanting to be alone. She was secretive and solitary, right? The room, which had been Mrs. Jekyll's, had an air of delicate femininity. Blue silk curtains matched the blue silk coverlet on the bed, and the furniture stood on slender mahogany legs as though about to start dancing. Catherine had the urge to scratch it all up. It reminded her too much of Lady Tibbet's house. She took off Holmes's frock coat, which she had been wearing since last night. It seemed 1,000 years ago. Surely there must be something for her to wear. From the wardrobe she chose a pair of drawers and an embroidered chemise. That would do. She opened the window. Below her was the courtyard that separated the main house from the laboratory, where Beatrice was probably sleeping. She looked up. There was a drain pipe running all the way to the third floor, close enough that she could reach it. How strong was it? Would it bear her weight? She climbed out the window and up the drain pipe. It was sturdy enough to support her weight, but ran up only to what must be a third-floor bathroom, or more likely a sink and water closet. If she could just reach from where the drain pipe ended to one of the window frames, and from there to the gutter, in a moment she was up on the roof, among the chimney pots. It was a clear day, clear for London, anyhow, and she could see across the tops of the houses. London seemed to go on forever. She turned and crossed the roof. She felt a savage delight in being up so high, the delight she must have felt on a cliff in the Andes before Moreau transformed her into a woman. In one direction was a succession of alleys and mews. In the other was Regent's Park, with its green treetops swaying in the wind. How strange life was. She had been born in the mountains of Argentina, then born again on Moreau's island. Now here she was, at the center of the largest city in the world. Somewhere in that city was Edward Prendick. One day she would meet him again, and then she would tear out his throat. Diana,
and you all think I'm violent.
Catherine, I'm supposed to be violent. I'm a puma, remember? Diana,
as though you let us forget it.
But for now, should she stay here? She could go anywhere. She could survive under any conditions. But Justine needed a home. This one would do, at least for now. After all, she had enjoyed the camaraderie of the circus. She supposed that was the human part of her, the part Moreau had created. She would have to tell Lorenzo what had happened to his performers. He had always treated her well, and he deserved to know, not the whole story, but at least that she and Justine had found another home. And then they would begin a new life. It would in some ways be not much different from the circus. Both the circus and the house on Park Terrace had their monsters. Catherine,
yes, Mary, I know how you feel about that word, but I'm not going to stop using it. So you can stop cluttering up my story with your objections.
The adventures of the previous night had not tired Catherine as much as the others. She was nocturnal, after all. But she, too, needed rest. She clambered down the drainpipe and climbed through the window, then curled up under the blue silk covers and fell asleep, twitching as she dreamed of hunting deer on the slopes of the Andes.
Justine, I like Catherine's writing. It's dramatic, perhaps overly dramatic at times, but I can see what she saw, feel what she felt, as an animal transformed by Dr. Moreau. That is good storytelling, I think.
Catherine. Thank you. And if any of you want to write this book, you're more than welcome to try. Beatrice was not asleep. She looked around the room that had once been a laboratory, and before that an operating theatre. Yes, she thought it would do. The glass dome let in plenty of light. She could put plants on the desks where students had once sat observing dissections and demonstrations. The laboratory could become an indoor greenhouse. Some of the plants would be poisonous. Would Mary allow that? She did not know. She climbed up the stairs to the office. What had happened here so long ago? How had Dr. Jekyll falsified his own death to escape as Hyde? The room itself was spotlessly clean. The only pieces of furniture were a desk and chair, two glass-fronted cabinets, empty now, and the sofa on which she had slept the first night she had arrived. In one corner stood a cheval glass. What must it have seemed so many years ago? Jekyll's transformations into Hyde, she guessed. She looked into its depths, but saw only herself, a woman of uncanny beauty. Beatrice.
Catherine, you know I don't think of myself that way.
Catherine. Well, everyone else does. Really, your modesty is one of the most annoying things about you. That and your absolute mania about votes for women and dress reform. And no, you can't comment here about the importance of the suffrage movement or the dangers of tight lacing. Diana.
Is this one of those scenes where the monster looks in a mirror?
It had been one of the most terrible nights of her life. She had almost killed another human being. A child, this time. She must never do that again. Here she could stay secluded, away from the others. And perhaps her medicines could heal, making up in some measure for the deaths she had caused. Beatrice lay down on the sofa and pulled a blanket over herself. She was so tired, not from lack of sleep, but from a sense of hopelessness that had been with her since the death of Giovanni. Here she thought she might find, not happiness, but peace. Beatrice closed her eyes and dreamed whatever flowers dream. Beatrice.
That's very poetic, but they don't dream anything. Flowers have no cerebral cortex.
Catherine. Oh, for goodness sake. Can't you be the romantic heroine? Mary is too sensible, Diana is too impulsive, and Justine is too tall. Beatrice.
But I'm not a romantic heroine. I'm a scientist.
When Mary woke again, it was almost dark. She looked at her wristwatch, but could not make out the hands. She must have slept all day. And in her clothes, too. She heard voices downstairs, and for a confused moment she thought it must be Enid and Nurse Adams. Then she remembered the events of the past week. Had it all really happened? It must have. She could not have made such a thing up. Not poisonous girls and beast men and Adam Frankenstein. Who else was awake? When she went downstairs, rubbing her eyes, she found they all were. The gas had been lit in the parlour and there was a fire in the grate. Catherine, Justine and Diana were sitting around the tea table, on which there were cakes and sandwiches, as she had predicted. Beatrice was still sitting away from the group, by the window. We didn't want to wake you, said Catherine. We've been making plans. What sort of plans? Were they going to stay? Or had they been talking about going back to the circus? Even Beatrice could make a good living in the circus sideshow. Mary hoped, more than she had hoped anything in the past week, that they would be staying. After all they had been through, she wanted them together, in this house. Just then, Alice walked into the parlour, holding a glass filled with... Well, it was green.
Mrs. Poole sent me up with this, miss,
she said to Beatrice, handing her the concoction.
She says she'll be up herself in a moment.
That's very kind of you, Alice, said Beatrice. Particularly since I almost poisoned you. I cannot apologize enough.
Oh, that weren't your fault. You couldn't help it, being all tied up.
Beatrice sipped from the glass and smiled.
Mrs. Poole is a genius, I think. This is perfect. Will you tell her from me, Alice? And if I am to remain here, if this is to become my home, you must call me by my name. I have no intention of standing on ceremony with anyone.
Yes, Miss Beatrice, said Alice. If you'll excuse me.
And then she was gone again, like a mouse that disappears into the woodwork before you've had the chance to blink.
I hope she's not afraid of me, said Beatrice, sipping her green sludge.
What in the world had Mrs. Poole put into it? It looked like weed soup.
After all, I almost killed her. No, she's just shy, said Mary. She always has been since she first came here. I would never have expected quiet little Alice to be as brave as she was last night. So, what were you talking about before I came in? Will you stay?
Of course we're going to stay, said Catherine, as though it were obvious. She picked up a sandwich, looked at it and said, Watercress, that's pig food. She handed it to Justine. Where's the ham? Just then Mrs. Poole came in with the teapot.
Mary, Mrs. Poole, do you realize that you're always coming in with tea?
Mrs. Poole, that's a good thing I am, or you girls would never eat with all the gallivanting you do. Alice followed, carrying the tea tray, with cups and saucers and all the usual implements. She arranged the cups and saucers on the table and Mrs. Poole poured out a cup of tea for each of them.
Mrs. Poole, would you please sit down for a moment, said Mary. You too, Alice. And take my tea, won't you? I'll get myself another cup in a moment. I need to ask you both a question.
Mrs. Poole sat down in an empty armchair. Alice took Mary's teacup with visible reluctance, as though it were one of Beatrice's poisons.
Oh, for goodness sake, do sit, Alice, or you'll spill your tea, said Mrs. Poole. I can see that we're going to be thoroughly modern in this house. What Mrs. Jekyll would think of it, I don't know. She had such strict notions of order and propriety. Well, at least you're all here, safe and sound, for one night.
Alice sat down on the carpet by Mrs. Poole's chair and drank her tea in small sips.
That's what I want to ask you about, said Mary. What if all of us were to live here together? I've asked Diana, Beatrice, Catherine and Justine to stay, and I'd like to ask Alice as well. But, Mrs. Poole, this is as much your home as mine. You've lived in it longer than I have. What do you say?
Mrs. Poole looked at them all appraisingly and shook her head.
You girls will be a lot of trouble, no doubt. Especially that one.
She nodded at Diana, who had just taken two sandwiches at once.
But I think you belong here, together. All I ask is that you let me know what you're doing, so I don't worry that you've been kidnapped or murdered.
And we'll help with the housework, Mrs. Poole, said Beatrice. And do have some cake. I'm sure it's delicious.
How would you know? Said Diana. You don't even eat. Well, I'll believe that about the housework when I see it, but I don't mind if I have a slice. Getting that oven to make cake was a triumph of mind over metal. It just goes to show that even at my time of life you can learn new tricks.
Mrs. Poole cut herself a generous slice of cake.
And Alice, said Mary, will you stay? Not just until you find a new situation, but for as long as you wish.
Alice nodded.
I miss. So long as I don't have to go on adventures, or, you know, die.
Mary smiled.
Our first adventure, I think, will be finding a way to support ourselves. We're going to run out of money quickly if we don't find work of some sort.
Beatrice drank the last of her sludge.
Thank you, Mrs. Poole. That was very refreshing. As I was saying before Mary came down, we should find work that suits our various talents and capacities. If you allow me, I will grow medicinal herbs.
The laboratory with its skylight is a perfect environment for them. I noticed what a limited pharmacopoeia the Royal Hospital has. Even the Royal College of Surgeons lacks some of the medicines my father was able to develop from his plants. I believe if we all gave it some thought, we could find ways to earn our keep, to pay for this house and our living expenses.
Mary.
And so we have. Beatrice's medicines sell consistently, and your books bring in royalties, Catherine. Justine's paintings are increasingly popular. The one of the girl with the lilacs is going to pay the water rates.
Diana.
Lilac time. What an absolutely rotten name.
Justine.
But people like it. They like to see things that are happy, and I'm good at flowers.
Catherine. Leave Justine alone. She can paint whatever she wants, and she brings in more money than you anyhow. Diana.
Once I'm a famous actress, I'll bring in more than the lot of you. You'll see.
Mary.
Well, for now, you're just in the variety show, so don't get too high and mighty. And I'm not sure you should be in that. It's barely respectable, and you really should be in school.
Diana.
Respectable, my arse! And as for school...
Catherine. Here I interrupt my narrative and Diana's subsequent diatribe to inform my readers that my first two novels, The Mysteries of Astarte and The Adventures of Rick Chambers, are available for sale in bookstores and train stations for only a shilling. The third novel in the series, Rick Chambers and Astarte, will be appearing for the Christmas season, followed by Rick Chambers on Venus, unless the publisher calls it Rick Chambers and the Caverns of Doom or something else entirely. I'm currently working on the fifth novel, and it would go much more quickly if this monster of a narrative didn't take up so much of my time.
Mary, I don't think your readers want an advertisement in the middle of the story.
Catherine, my readers appreciate hearing about my forthcoming publications, thank you very much. That was the first meeting of the Athena Club. Oh, we didn't call it that. Not then. Not until several months later, when Justine suggested the name. Readers who remember their classical mythology will immediately realize its significance. Athena, born from the head of her father, Zeus. We do not claim the wisdom of Athena, but we identify with her dubious parentage. But that night was when the club started, really. With all of us sitting in the parlour having tea, telling Mrs. Poole what had happened the night before, to her shocked horror. Discussing what we were going to do, how we were going to investigate the Alchemical Society. The next day we would continue to talk about practicalities, how we were going to support ourselves and live together without Beatrice poisoning us all or Mrs. Poole strangling Diana. But that was the moment when we knew, when it became real. Now, when you approach the front door of 11 Park Terrace, you will see a brass plaque directly over the bell pool. The Athena Club. That is what we are. A very exclusive club. For monsters.
Mary. Except we're not monsters.
Diana.
Says you.
The next day was Sunday, so we all went to church except Catherine, who said religion was a fraud and a sham. We were all idiots for believing that God the Father lived up in the sky and would bless us if we were good, punish us if we were bad, like Moreau in his compound.
Why do I have to go if Catherine doesn't? Said Diana. Because you're still a child and you need to be raised properly, said Mrs. Poole,
who was helping us with our gloves and hats. Mary had somehow found enough gloves and hats for everyone.
But I'm 14 and she's only 10, said Diana. I mean, from the time she became a human being.
You have to count in cat years, said Catherine. As a puma, I was already on my own and ready to mate.
Mary.
What about your human years? Do they count as human years? Will you age at a normal rate now? I mean, for a woman?
Catherine. I don't know. Pumas only live about 15 years in the wild. It would be rather awful to die at 15, don't you think? But I simply don't know. I don't think even Moreau knew.
or cared about that effect of the humanizing process. He ignored his beast men after they were created. It was the act of creation itself that